George Orwell's chilling novel 1984 imagines a totalitarian surveillance state that seeks to control everything, even people's thoughts. Last year, sales of the book soared after Edward Snowden revealed the National Security Agency's large-scale program to collect the phone data of millions of Americans. New Yorker staff writer George Packer joins us now to talk about 1984 and why it still resonates 66 years after it was published. Mr. Packer is the author of The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America, which won the National Book Award in 2013, and The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Thanks. Always good to be with you, Leonard.
And if you, our listeners, would like to join the conversation, you can leave a comment on our show page or write to us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. We've gotten a lot of comments on our show page about what a big impression 1984 has made on readers. Why do you think the book continues to resonate?
I just think Orwell saw so clearly into the mechanism of modern control of states over people. And although he was writing it in the middle of sort of the peak of totalitarianism, Nazism was only a few years dead. Soviet communism was in its upswing. Eastern Europe was more and more under the control of Stalinism. It still has this meaning for us. And I think he wrote it partly in order to warn democratic societies, you know, don't imagine that there's nothing here for you. Don't imagine that these tendencies couldn't begin to seep into our own society.
Although I remember in 1984, a lot of people snickered, hey, well, it never happened. And next year, this book will be totally irrelevant. And yet, when the Snowden revelations occurred, sales of the book shot up.
You know, in that year, 1984, I remember the same dismissive comments, but one of the most famous TV ads in history aired that year, the Apple ad, in which Big Brother is on the screen chanting to the drones and a woman throws a sledgehammer and smashes the screen. And so Apple was striking a blow against Big Brother. Well, today, if there is an element of Big Brother in our lives, I think technology has to be included. I think Facebook and Google and all the social media and the search engines, which seem to know everything about us,
well, we're complicit in it to some degree,
absolutely,
aren't we?
Absolutely.
Which Orwell did not foresee.
Yeah, I think what Orwell saw was the will to power on the part of an elite, which then set up these incredible mechanisms, which he saw so deeply and found a fictional vehicle to express it so well. But yes, today there was actually an essay many decades ago under the title Big Brother is You Watching, which reversed Orwell's formula. And that says there's something in us that allows us to be taken over by whether it's the TV or the internet.
But even then, we're seeing things like experiments being done on us by Facebook. And is it OkCupid that...
You got me. I'm out of my depth on that one. But Facebook was doing experiments in emotion control. We have to be careful about how far to take the analogy, because East Germany and the Soviet Union, let alone Nazi Germany...
Well, Stasi were Big Brother.
There was political control to the nth degree. And Orwell's 1984 is a very accurate picture of certain societies, so that if you were a North Korean today and somehow managed to get a copy of that book, you would think that this was a guide to your life. Whereas for us, it's more the resonances, the nuances that suggest we have these tendencies, we have to keep an eye on them.
Was this Orwell's first work of fiction? Because he'd written a lot of nonfiction.
No, in fact, he started out with the ambition to be a novelist. Burmese Days was his first novel. He wrote a bunch in the 30s. Animal Farm in the 40s could be called a novel. This was his last work of fiction, and he wrote it pretty much on his deathbed.
And Animal Farm was also about the Soviet Union, actually more explicitly about the Soviet Union.
Yeah, Animal Farm is brilliant in a different way. It's very short. The language is beautiful. And he found this simple way of telling a story of a revolution gone wrong that managed to find an audience around the world because it had that fairy tale quality.
Was there always a political element to his writing other than Down and Out in Paris and London, which is about surviving on pretty much not even $5 a day, more like a 50 cents a day?
As a dishwasher in Paris and then as a homeless man in London, even that book, you can see Orwell almost in training for his later writing, because he's always observing the way society works and the injustices that are inherent in the way people deal with each other. And those are the things that always draw his eye. And so I think his whole work is of a piece, fiction, nonfiction, essays, books.
The Road to Wigan Pier, for example.
All of it. Homage to Catalonia. His essays, I think, are the pure Orwell is in those essays.
Do you think that to some degree his fear of totalitarianism or his insights came from fighting in the Spanish Civil War?
That was when he first saw wholesale lies being adopted and accepted on a large scale by a democratic society, by people he knew in Britain and in Western Europe, where the Soviet lie that there was a fascist fifth column inside the anarchist movement in Barcelona, et cetera, which was one of the dirty little struggles of the Spanish Civil War. He was in Barcelona. He was in Spain. So he saw it happening. I think that gave him the clearest sense of the threat that totalitarianism posed in being able to change the past. Not just the present and the future, but actually rewriting the past, which is so relevant to 1984.
It's a part of the plot where Winston actually goes back and corrects the news of the past so that it now coincides with the present reality.
I think Orwell, there's a line in 1984, I believe, where he says, "Whoso controls the present controls the past, and who controls the past controls the future." If you can change history, if you can alter it, you can destroy people's memory of any alternative and make them incapable of imagining an alternative once that's happened, and then you have thought control, which is another great phrase from 1984.
If Big Brother said Oceania would manufacture 3 million cars one year but ended up manufacturing only 1 million, Winston would go back and correct the record. As a journalist, do you find this idea totally strange?
Yes, partly because I live under the discipline of the fact-checking department at The New Yorker, which is sort of like the 180-degree polar opposite of what Winston Smith's job was. They sit at their desks and make sure everything that we write is accurate. But what Winston Smith's job is to do is to, in a way, erase the very idea of objective truth. That's what Orwell was most afraid of, not so much public executions, which are in 1984 and are terrifying, but the most terrifying thing is the ability to change truth and make truth irrelevant, and that becomes an instrument of control for the state.
And it gives us words like newspeak, which we use regularly.
We use so much of the language of 1984, thought crime, Big Brother is watching you, war is peace. Newspeak is one of Orwell's most brilliant inventions because in it he saw that language was the key to thought control. And if you could eliminate words, you know, the great thing about newspeak is they're getting rid of words. They're reducing the vocabulary to such a minimum that thought crime, thinking things that the state doesn't want you to think, becomes impossible because we need those words in order to think those things. So eventually the state will control the contents of our skull.
After the Snowden revelations, people started saying Big Brother is watching us.
And that's,
so much of this book has entered into the public consciousness.
I think there's a lot of Orwell that's relevant for today.
Is Big Brother all the more sinister because he's faceless and nameless?
Well, he has a face, and it's on posters that are all over Oceania. And it's essentially, I think, the face of a Stalin-like. He's got a great big handlebar mustache, and he's sort of dark-haired and ruggedly handsome. I also think of Saddam Hussein's face when I imagine Big Brother. But today, Big Brother is inside our laptops and our smartphones. And I find that, yes, exactly, more sinister because it's depersonalized.
My guest is George Packer, and we're talking about the novel written by another George Orwell, 1984. It is now over 60 years old. You can find it in your local bookstore in a paperback edition from Plume. Scott from New Jersey asks, should we interpret Orwell's 1984 as his prediction for 1984 in our linear sense of time, or was he writing about some distant future?
Yeah, I don't.
Why
think,
did he pick 1984?
I don't think it's a prediction. He picked that year because it was an inversion of 1948. which was the year he finished the book. So it's a coincidence. If he had finished the book in 1949, the book would be called 1994. So it's a, in a sense, a meaningless date. It's not a prediction. It's a warning. It's a picture of a possible future that people in democratic societies have to always be on guard against.
It's a dystopic novel before we started seeing floods of dystopic novels.
You know, people compare it to Brave New World. And when I was in high school, we read them both. It was on our most high school reading list back then. I don't know if it still is. Brave New World was a picture of the future as pleasure. Our agency, our independence, our ability to act has been taken away by pleasure. Orwell saw something else. What he saw was pain and power and a really dingy life as being closer to what the future was going to hold. And in a way, for a long time, Orwell's picture seemed truer. Today in America, Brave New World seems relevant as well, because we seek our pleasures in entertainment, in our devices, and in some ways our sense of agency is taken away by that.
On another level, 1984 is more than just about surveillance. In this country, we have growing division between the wealthiest and the rest of Americans. And some people see amassing great wealth, succeeding as being especially American, while others see it as un-American for the 1% to control 35.6% of the wealth in this country. Now, you've been writing about Americans' feelings about our current situation, the Great Unwinding, for example. What are they telling you about that?
Yeah, I think it's not so much the accumulation of wealth, which we've always had in this country, and the aspiration to make money.
Has it ever been in the hands of so few, so much?
I think once, 100 years ago, during the Gilded Age, which led to the Progressive Era and the New Deal.
And Teddy Roosevelt.
And that was the correction. We haven't had a correction. Instead, we see a repetition of that period 100 years ago with robber barons at the top. Today, they have different names: Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and they're also philanthropic, as Andrew Carnegie was back then. But the amount of power in private hands is greater than it's been in 100 years. And I think when that becomes an obstacle to equal opportunity, when people don't feel they can move up in American life, that's when it's a threat to the idea that Americans have of what we're about.
1984 is quite pessimistic about the future. Did you encounter growing pessimism about the future when you were writing The Great Unwinding?
Absolutely. I mean, in a way, people's general feeling about the future was more pessimistic than about their own lives, which they hadn't lost faith in. The characters in that book are still struggling. But the polls show that something like 80% of Americans think their children will not be as well off as they are. And that's a complete reversal of what we think of as the American dream.
Well, we're caught up in some kind of dichotomy here. On the one hand, many Americans believe there is no such thing as climate change, despite what the scientists say. On the other hand, they're worried about what the Earth is going to look like in 50 years for their children and grandchildren.
And you could look at the reasons why climate change is even questioned and say, well, we do have a thought control in this country, and it's cable news, which some people are plugged into 24 hours a day, the one that appeals to their worldview, and it feeds them their own corrected version of reality. The Ministry of Truth is there at Fox News, and there are a lot of people walking around who have no idea what objective reality is on the question of climate change, because they're fed a line by our own particular ministries of truth.
The goal of Newspeak is to strip the language of so much vocabulary and then reinvent it to include only the words that let people express what Big Brother wants them to express. Is the idea that people won't be able to think for themselves because they don't have the words to do it?
Exactly. Once you no longer have the word for freedom or for dissent or liberty, then when the word is gone, the concept goes with it. And once the concept is gone, people can no longer think it. And so as one of Winston's colleagues in the Ministry of Truth tells him, don't you understand the purpose of Newspeak is to make thought crime impossible so that the party will have complete control? But you know, Leonard, there's an interesting twist on Orwell today, which is Orwell makes us aware of the danger of an all-powerful government. But I think we have another problem in this country. We have not really fallen into something like Orwell's 1984. What we have is a public that no longer believes that it can act to change society. And that is partly because we are such a libertarian country. Orwell was not a libertarian. He was a liberal. He believed in freedom of thought, freedom of the individual, but he was a democratic socialist. He believed that collective action was necessary in order to create justice. People who take 1984 as a libertarian manifesto, I think, have the wrong idea about it. Because, in fact, Winston Smith is constantly looking for some organization that he can attach himself to that might – it's called the Brotherhood in 1984 – that might be capable of changing things for the better. And so, in a way, it's a blow against the idea of the absolutely free individual.
Another major theme in the book is that ongoing war shapes people, that things like torture and surveillance and censorship become acceptable to people when they're always at war. Do you see this as especially prescient?
I think during the post 9/11 years, a lot of Americans accepted a kind of constant state of war. The war on terror was to be an endless war, and that's an Orwellian concept. Torture became not just a government practice, but something that a lot of people didn't want to know too much about because they didn't want to have to question.
Or they didn't want to use the word. The Times only recently has finally agreed to use the word torture in describing things like waterboarding.
Instead of enhanced interrogation technique, which also has a
newspeak
quality. You know, I think the fact that that President Obama at the beginning of his term said no more torture, the fact that Americans don't want to be in Iraq and Afghanistan, the fact that there's a real reluctance to get involved right now in stopping ISIS in Iraq, all those show that we are still a society in which the public can bring about some change in government policy, and governments are rational and can respond to things that are not working or that are wrong.
In reading 1984, it's difficult not to think about the Taliban or especially ISIS today, because ISIS is now killing people who refuse to convert to their form of Islam.
I just saw a documentary about ISIS in which a man is publicly executed, crucified, in fact, for some crime, and there's a crowd of people watching, taking pictures with their smartphones, and among them are children. And it made me.
This is from a Vice documentary.
This is from the really good Vice documentary about ISIS. And it made me think of that moment in 1984 when Winston's neighbor, the Parsons, had these children who are avid members of the SPIES, the Young Kids Movement for the Party. And they are disappointed that day that Winston goes to fix the blocked sink because they didn't get to go to the public execution of the Eurasian prisoners. So ISIS, to me, is at the very outer edge of – and yet it also is trying to create a state. So unlike al-Qaeda, it brings up images of 1984 in a way that no jihadi group has done so far.
Well, maybe the Taliban, because they both believe in the destruction of art, ban music, don't guarantee any freedom of religion. They have strict laws imposed on how you can dress and what you can read, and they limit access to education.
All that is true, and the Taliban is another great example. I think ISIS is more sophisticated. It's more Western educated. They just produced an annual report, 400-something pages long, as if they were a major corporation. The Taliban did not produce annual reports. They didn't document themselves in the same way. So ISIS, to me, has a closer feeling to the kind of sophisticated state control that you find in 1984.
It's also trying to establish itself as a serious nation in itself, the first caliphate. You wrote about a man you know in Iraq named Karim who fled ISIS. What happened to him?
Karim is a Yazidi. He had worked for the U.S. Army as an interpreter in the early years of the war. And when the town of Sinjar was overrun by ISIS a few weeks ago, he and his family barely got out of their town, which was near Sinjar, alive, along with other Yazidis, and joined this massive exodus of cars and people on foot, some of whom went up into Mount Sinjar and became, you know, the victims of terrible deprivation, heat, thirst, starvation, and others got out and went to northern Iraq to Kurdistan, and he is now in Kurdistan with his family, which is a relatively safe area. But their entire community has been uprooted and destroyed, and that was the basis for their religion, which had somehow survived centuries in this inhospitable place, many attempts at eliminating them. ISIS is the latest.
But ISIS has also gone after Shiites. It's gone after Christians. It was only during this crisis with the Yazidis that the world really started to pay much attention, and the president finally decided to do something. Why do you think it's taken so long? Because they've been beheading people, and they've been stoning people they accuse of adultery for a while now.
I mean, their atrocities are endless, and
I understand that they kind of semi-crucified a boy of 10 because he wasn't fasting during Ramadan.
I think as long as all these grotesque crimes were inflicted on people in places that we didn't know about or didn't seem to have anything to do with us, Americans who are weary of war, and President Obama, who's wary of any re-involvement in Iraq, wanted to just keep it at arm's length. The Yazidi case was so much an obvious attempted genocide under the eyes of the world as it was happening, like Srebrenica, that it was just impossible for the president to ignore it. I still wonder how much of a commitment our government is going to make to combating ISIS, because it's an expansionist movement.
I just saw a documentary about the last days in Vietnam, and I saw so many parallels that it was kind of shocking. Americans did not want to go in there and save anybody because they just had way too much. And the same feeling seems to be afoot in regard to Iraq and to Syria to some degree as well.
And this is where one theme of 1984 cuts against another theme, the theme of endless war as a tool of keeping people under control, having spies and enemies as an excuse to control the public, cuts against the desire for solidarity with victims of oppression and victims of suffering. And so we have had so much war over the past decade that I have this sense that we don't really want to hear about it. When Christians are driven out of Mosul, when boys are crucified in Syria, when Yazidis are practically driven to extinction. And that, I think, would disturb Orwell, who never lost his sense of solidarity with victims of oppression and of tyranny.
Does 1984 make us realize that we should care about these things around the world, that they should matter to us even if they don't affect us on a personal level?
I think so. I think that's the meaning of Orwell's entire career, of all his writing. But as I said earlier, the book has been taken as a libertarian document with all the emphasis on the freedom of the individual and none of the emphasis on solidarity. But Winston is not just looking for freedom. He's also looking for solidarity and for a group that he can join that can overthrow the state. Of Big Brother, which never happens, of course. Instead, it leads to his demise. But that desire to struggle and to join with others must never die. And Winston Smith's diary, which he begins the book with as an act of rebellion, is a record of that struggle.
An act of rebellion because the government is really doing everything to dehumanize people.
Keeping a diary in this old book that he's bought in a secondhand shop in an obscure neighborhood is in itself an act of revolt and could get him killed, because it means he's trying to live a separate and independent autonomous life.
In 1984, it's almost impossible to have a real relationship with anyone else.
And at one point he says that the party's real aim is not to kill love, but to kill desire. And so the woman who becomes his lover starts out, as Winston sees it, as this horrible member of the junior anti-sex league wearing this red sash around her waist that essentially means don't touch me. He's wrong about her. Turns out that she is full of desire, and they have this not very well-drawn love affair. Orwell was not great at relationships between the sexes. But it is, and it's an idea, an important one, which is to say, as long as people want each other and are separate from each other, are born separately, see each other as different, and yet want communion, the party can never own them completely.
Dave from New Jersey writes in to say he sees a connection between 1984 and Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, which looks at television's effect on society. He wonders, is there a difference between thought control through news and thought control through entertainment?
Yeah, I think Neil Postman was quite prophetic. And that essay I mentioned earlier by Mark Crispin Miller, Big Brother Is You Watching, is kind of a Postman-esque critique of TV. Yeah, in a way, it's more sinister when it's voluntary, when we put it in our living room and turn it on. You know, in 1984, you have to have a telescreen in your room, and it has to be on all the time so that they can watch you, whereas we put it there as a matter of choice and give ourselves up to this thing. Now, of course, it's not a TV screen. It's a smartphone, but it seems to have even more of an effective control over us.
Although I gather in North Korea, you have to keep your radio on it all the time, listening to the only station that the government broadcasts.
Somehow Orwell just knew all of this, even before it had happened.
But the book is so depressing that it can make reality seem a lot better than it probably is.
Have you ever seen the movie with John Hurt as Winston Smith? I think it's a brilliant film version of 1984. Maybe your listeners will want to get it. It shows how dingy and grim life is under the rule of Big Brother, because essentially everything is a lie, including the idea that people are happy.
But I hope that if you haven't read 1984, that this conversation will inspire you to pick up the 60th anniversary edition from Plume or any other edition of the book. My great thanks to George Packer for coming by today to talk about it on our book club.
My pleasure, Leonard.